Good afternoon, everybody. Hi, welcome. My name is Drew Harvell. I'm Associate Director for Environment in the Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. And on behalf of the Atkinson Center, I'm delighted to welcome you to the second in our Outside Voices series. Our discussion this afternoon, Important Science in an Urgent Age, Climate Change and Hydraulic Fracturing, with our guest speaker, Andrew Revkin of the New York Times, perhaps the most influential and respected reporter on the environment. As many of you know, since you're all here, he's the author of the Dot Earth blog in the New York Times, in which he examines efforts to balance human affairs with the planet's limits. He has spent nearly three decades covering subjects ranging from the assault on the Amazon rainforest to the changing conditions around the Arctic, from the troubled relationship of climate science and politics to the environmental impacts of rising human populations and resource appetites. From 1995 through 2009, Andy covered the environment for the Times as a staff reporter, and his quarter century of coverage of global warming has earned most of the major awards for science journalism, along with the John Chancellor Award for Sustained Journalistic Excellence from Columbia University. He has been a pioneer in multimedia communication, blogging and shooting still and video imagery in far-flung places. Dot Earth was actually created under John Guggenheim Foundation Fellowship. Revkin has also carried his journalism to a new generation, and the North Pole was here. Puzzles and Perils at the Top of the World, the first book on Arctic climate change written for the whole family. His other books are the Burn... His other books are The Burning Season, which was the basis for a much-lauded HBO film, and Global Warming, Understanding the Forecast, which accompanied the first museum exhibition on climate change at the American Museum. In his history, he's been a senior writer for Discover and the LA Times. He has a bio degree from Brown and a master's in journalism from Columbia, and is currently a Pace University senior fellow. In his review of Who Speaks for Climate, Revkin emphasizes the role of media as a central voice in a larger cacophony on climate change. And it's this issue he seeks to lead a discussion on this afternoon. In his copious spare time, he's an occasional accompanist for Pete Seeger and plays in a twangy roots jam band, Breakneck Ridge. The structure for today's event is that Andy will kick this off with about 20 minutes of his current thoughts on climate change and energy policy challenges, and then we will open it up to your questions. So let's give him a warm welcome.
Great. It's great to be here and to see you all here. And I had some wonderful exchanges earlier in the day, including with a marvelous array of people on faculty who are seriously engaged in trying to understand the gas challenge. There's these resources that have only recently become available at large scale. And can you do it at scale, responsibly, safely? What trade-offs do we face in dealing with our energy appetites in a planet that's finite with an atmosphere that clearly can only absorb greenhouse gases at a certain rate? And we're surrounded by these kinds of wicked questions, and actually, climate particularly is, there are several papers I've written about periodically in the last few years. These papers have articulated that climate challenge is actually super wicked. If you Google for super wicked and climate change, you'll see some really interesting and depressing analysis led by initially Kelly Levin at Yale, who is not much older than the youngest among you when she wrote the paper. So you can make an influence in the discourse even early on. I'm going to focus not so much on science in an urgent age itself as science communication in an urgent age, because really the issues, the science is kind of what it is. We all know how, well, we don't, those of you who have dived into science or tried to understand it know it's a process. There's a lot of complexity. There's always disagreement. Disagreement is what drives science, whittling away at the known, the things that are asserted as a new body of understanding. But it's how we convey that to the broader public that you get into challenges, and especially now. And for many reasons, the super wicked nature of the climate problem, more than a few people in the sustainability arena have looked like this photographer. I photographed at the Copenhagen Climate Talks in 2009 at the end of 2 weeks of rancorous exchanges. And that didn't amount to anything. When that was the year that everyone was hoping, well, now we'll finally get it. This sort of sense. Problem with the mic. Let's switch to that. Can you hear me okay? There is kind of a buzzy weirdness. At any rate, we've all had this feeling of inertia, of paralysis, of depression like this guy. And the trajectories are pretty straightforward. You know, we're climbing up, we're explosively growing. We have been for 200 years. And that's just sheer numbers. You know, there were 1 billion people on the whole planet in 1800. Now there are 1 billion teenagers on planet Earth. So that gives you, just that figure alone should get your attention. 1 billion teenagers. Wow. And that doesn't, there's another 1 billion kids behind those teenagers just waiting to be teenagers. And I have 2 sons who are kind of right in that mix. So there's a big challenge. How do we feed that number of people? You know, I think I can. This wonderful political cartoon from a few years back by Steve Greenberg, who used to work at a newspaper. But now he's freelance, and like many, the journalism world is sort of devolving and evolving at the same time. So again, we used to rely on science journalists to tell us all these things. How do we move to a post-media landscape of ideas that conveys meaning still? So that's just the numbers, you know. And then there's appetites. A Times photographer took this picture a few years ago at one of those Black Friday sales at Target. Now, can you imagine 9 billion people doing that? Right now, it's a few billion at most who would be characterized as middle class on planet Earth. But the idea of 9 billion people, and the thing that really gets me is, remember, Black Friday has already evolved to Black Thursday. You know how it's crept? There's been like Friday creep, or whatever you want to call it. Now it's spilled into Thanksgiving itself. We have this urgent need to buy stuff that's partially through all the information we're bathed in from advertising continually from the time we're tots on forward. So 9 billion people with explosively growing appetites for those who have money to spend leads to enormous impacts on the planet and makes you really wonder, can this work? Can we fit this level of appetite on this planet? And the question, you know, most scientists would say no. And so far, I've come up and used the metaphor of bacteria growing on agar as being kind of there's not a lot to distinguish us from that yet. You know, we do have these brains, they're marvelous, but when you look at most trajectories on this planet, whether it's elephant ivory, which I wrote about today on .earth, or carbon-based fuels, we kind of have still this pretty much fundamental habit, if it's there, use it. And if you use it efficiently, then that just gives you more money to use it more. That's the rebound effect. So my question that I've explored on .earth periodically is, can we get ahead of the curve? Can we, before we hit the edge of the Petri dish, which is essentially what scientists have been delineating for the last 40 or 50 years, can we use our brains to be something other than bacteria on agar? Can we use this thing in a sustainable way? This is the ultimate question. This is the sustainable technology question, not like what kind of computer to use. And then the trajectories, you know, are pretty unnerving. This is this year's sea ice retreat, the last 40 days of it. And you look at the level of the Arctic Ocean, the amount of blue there, that compare that to 30 years ago, it's about a 50% reduction in ice extent from 30 years ago. And in the summer, at the peak of the summer, the late August, early September peak. So what does that mean? You know, it means that there's changes afoot that are large. But there are also lots of questions about you know, earlier periods when Earth was warm, including in the last few thousand years. We don't have a lot of understanding how to compare this to what's been going on. So you can't just look at that and say, woe is me, we're doomed. It's more complicated than that. Yet I would encourage those in the back of the room, there are seats down here if you want to migrate forward. And the fire marshal would probably like that. So as I said, scientists, so here's the scientist's challenge. The scientists, Betsy Colbert wrote this a few years ago in her book, that there's this gap between what scientists understand and what the public understands. Jim Hansen has been making this point for years now. And so here in 2007, this is Martin Parry at the rollout of the the IPCC report of that year, the fourth report of this Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change since it formed in the late 80s. And he's basically telling you there's the edge of the Petri dish. He's pointing to it. And there's food, water, and the other essential components of how we, the resources we need. And he's essentially saying, the edge of the Petri dish. And the question, of course, for us is, are we listening? And so far, this gets back to the teenage metaphor, which has appeared on Dot Earth before a number of times. We don't really want to hear that.
You know what kind of drunken brawls those kind of parties turn into? It's not a place for kids.
A minute ago, you said you didn't care if he drinks.
He said a little drink.
You're tearing me apart!
So we societally, so far, we're James Dean, and the scientist is Jim Backus, you know, the chiding parent. And it didn't work very well for him to keep chiding the child. And it hasn't worked very well for the science community. So what do? You have all this sense of urgency. You have this sense of information being clear. The basics of climate, the basics of what we're doing to biodiversity are crystal clear. And so how can you engage? And that's where this tension comes in that we'll be discussing in a more open forum in a few minutes. How can you be effective and accurate at the same time? How can you be impactful and accurate? How do you step out of that cautious need for the scientists to make sure you articulate the uncertainties, even as you articulate the powerful basics? When we're really, the basics are boring. You know, we don't really want to know the basics. We want to know the leading edge stuff, and that's more complicated. What do you do in those situations? And we'll talk about that. Now there's another level of depression I want to take you to before I bring you up at the end. And this level of depression has to do with our inconvenient mind, as I wrote a few years ago. Just to give you a sense of how this all works, we're all in bubbles. We're all in compartments. We're all in tribes. Everyone in this room fits into some sociological group. At Cultural Cognition, the Dan Kahane's group at Yale and George Mason University, George Washington. Maybe it is George Mason, I can't remember. Anyway, go to culturalcognition.net and look around, and you'll see that essentially you can demonstrate empirically that we're divided pretty primally into different people with different reactions to risk and different reactions to problems. There are the libertarians among us and the liberals among us, and their labels for them are just a little bit different. It's individualists and communitarians, meaning, and you know what those people are like. I'm sure you all know individualists and you all know communitarians. Communitarians are all about us. They have a big we map, as Dan Siegel at UCLA talks about our we map. That's our sense of community. And the individualist has a bigger me map, as Dan Siegel says. And so how do you work with that? Well, you have to know, this is essentially, I did this, when I learned of this work, I kind of dug in for this the last few years. And then I looked at Nobel Prize winners who have beliefs about global warming. And I use the word beliefs intentionally, because not all of our reaction to knowledge is some of it is belief-based. It is a belief. It's a sense of embracing or rejecting an idea. And so here you have four Nobel Prize winners in physics who have fundamentally divergent views on global warming, one of whom lives right here, Ivar Gaever up in the upper right-hand corner, who doesn't look like that anymore. That was in the 1970s, has rejected the kind of Al Gore vision of a climate crisis utterly, and he thinks it's a form of religion at this point. He doesn't see it the basis in data. Steve Chu, Burton Richter, Robert Laughlin, they all have different views of this issue, and they all have a lot of knowledge. And they've actually done empirical studies that show that more knowledge often makes you more dug in on your worldview. And some people in this room are probably working on this point. So when you as a journalist, having spent 20 or plus years trying to convey the climate story, you know, well, I wrote magazine articles, I wrote a book in 1992, I wrote a kid's book in 2007, I worked on a documentary on the Arctic in 2005. So I'm like working on all these media, trying to tell the story of climate change, figuring maybe there'll be one magical medium that will finally get people to understand. And then you look at this work and you realize, oh my God, we're all stuck in our buckets and you're not gonna nudge people into having a new worldview based on information. The information just hardens their views, and that's kind of a wake-up call. And one thing that led me out of full-time journalism to academia was I wanted to figure this out. You know, that's why my title at Pace is Senior Fellow for Environmental Understanding. I just figured I invented that title. And because it's about the whole pipeline. I'm not just going to keep putting out information for the rest of my life, knowing that it's, you know, like throwing something at a wall. So, and then the last depressing thing for many people my age is that in the old days, way back in the 20th century, and I bet almost half of this room has spent more than half of your life in this 21st century. And for us 20th century folks, that's scary. That there are already people, adults alive, who've spent more time in the 21st century than the last century is a scary thought. But you know, when I was growing up, there was a guy, this old avuncular guy with silver hair and a trustworthy voice, who would say, "That's the way it is. Tuesday, November 5th, 1967. And you could just kind of eat your supper and kind of go home with that thought. And now it's like this. So on an issue like climate change, you can, back then, we and also the nightly news was at dinner time. We would watch, we'd be having our spaghetti or mac and cheese, watching, absorbing Walter Cronkite's view of, Vietnam. And then we'd go on. And now you sit there, you all have your own comfort food. It's like the world's biggest buffet. We now, with the web, we have an information buffet. You can listen to Rush Limbaugh, or you can listen to NPR, or you can, so you're still dining on comfort food, but you're in a bubble. And that's, to me, also depressing. But one thing I've done, tried to do at Pace University, is try to figure out new models for engaging people to getting them out of their bubbles, at least briefly, to confront in a constructive way other visions of the world. Now here we're going to build into the good news. There is good news. First of all, climate matters. It's not like writing about, I don't know. There's some things, the Higgs boson matters hugely to like five people. And it matters, fundamentally, essentially, to, our understanding of the universe and all that stuff, which is really big. But climate matters in a day-to-day basis. It matters if you're in a developing country, it matters that much more. The Russian fires, the Pakistani floods, the tornadoes in Joplin, it matters. So you can get people's attention. That's not hard. Water matters hugely. Lack of clean water leads to huge losses, avoidable losses. I took that picture in the Amazon when I was reporting the burning season, my book, in 1989. And it's so jarring to walk into a funeral parlor in Manaus, which was already a big city, and see coffins in all sizes, like Starbucks cups. And to know that's utterly unremarkable still today in many parts of the world says to me, water matters. And it says to me also that there's huge opportunities to make people's lives better right now. And when their lives are better, they're more apt to be able to think about things like the environment or climate change or biodiversity. So water and lack of water matters hugely. Too much water matters hugely. And it matters around here. This was right where I live a year. Well, for Irene took away one of our roads. Phillips Brook Road became Phillips Brook. And that's my neighbor's dog. So you can engage at the level of your town board meeting because where I live now, we're still overdue for the FEMA money, the Emergency Management Agency money, to repair roads. And when you look at what our requirements for road reconstruction in this country still are basically to return the road to the condition it was in. Instead of thinking forward, we're in a realm where virtually all models and actually some measurements point to more heavy precipitation events in a warming world. So why would you have a standard that builds to the existing road standard in a changing climate? And that's a conversation you could have in a community that's reality-based, that doesn't get complicated by the mitigation issue. What do we do about global warming, about the greenhouse gas problem? You can have this cogent discussion of exposure to risk and split it off and have people with divergent views engage. And I think that's one way forward. Energy matters. It matters when the 2 billion people who have no sources of sustainable energy matters hugely to their lives. And this is the spent fuel pool at Indian Point. I got to spend time in that building a year ago. And it's interesting to get in there and try to understand more about how to handle the fuel issue at nuclear power plants. So we're surrounded by energy questions in the world of energy abundance. We have the issues of how we get sources that are sustainable, whether it's fracking or nuclear power, or how can you ever have renewables at a scale that would supplant the need for those other options. And then again, 2 billion people on the planet have no light bulb. The kids in this picture at the top there, they're in Guinea, in a slum in the capital city. And to do their homework, they have to walk to the parking lot at the airport, because that's the only place there are electric lights. And that's just like the coffins in the preceding image. There's stuff to do right now. You can make their lives better right now, finding ways to bring energy on a small scale to either an urban setting like that in a slum or obviously in rural settings. And I have a whole another hour I could spend showing you examples of some of the experiments that are underway and the renewable stuff in rural areas that are off the grid. And then finally, the same social science that says we're in buckets says that while we're in buckets on some things, we're not in buckets on others. Now, this was data collected in 2009 by the Six Americas Project, led by people at Yale University. And essentially, they've identified six kinds of Americans in dealing with climate and energy. And they range from, as you can see, alarmed to dismissive, and with big bubbles in between that I think basically are all the same bubble, people who don't give a hoot. They're disengaged or busy or whatever. So to me, there's really just three bubbles. But you get the idea. There's sectors of society. Those bubbles indicate the size. Now, so when they were in 2009, the run-up to the cap and trade bill, they did this survey, and they found that even people who were alarmed by global warming were only halfway up the scale. They were at the maybe point on supporting that piece of legislation. So whoever thought that bill had a chance, hadn't really seen this work. If people who are alarmed about global warming were only in the maybe category on that bill, that says that was doomed. Now, when you ask the same people, support for providing rebates for purchases of solar panels and fuel-efficient vehicles, everybody is at least maybe, including the dismissives on global warming. And then, of course, the alarms are saying, yeah, that's good. We need to have incentives for that. Now, the economists I talk to say, well, that's just the difference there is just one is taking away money. You know, it's costly. Cap and trade. Cap is like negative. And a giveaway is, whoa, cool, this is a party. Now, you could say, well, okay, that's all we're seeing. We're just seeing that people like things given to them. But then they ask this question, support for requiring mandate, that's not exactly a Tea Party comfort zone. Requiring 45 miles per gallon fuel efficiency across vehicle fleets, even at a $1,000 premium. So something's going to cost you more, it's going to be required, and it's going to make the world better because it's using energy less. And even then, look at that. The dismissives even were almost maybe. And so that says to me, this isn't just about giving away stuff, that there's cross referencing here. There's a way to find issues that are highly germane to the climate challenge that where you don't end up butting heads. And that's what I try to do on .earth and more generally try to find the places where there's agreement. Just earlier today, I found substantial agreement among faculty members here who have a lot of divergence on some aspects of the fracking problem. And that's what I look for, because you know, otherwise we could spend the rest of our lives just going, you know, ban this, go ahead, and it doesn't really get you anywhere. Now, and there's ways to do this with the way we talk. So much of the climate crisis or global warming challenge is people batting around ways to describe something without really knowing that they even have the same description. So when people talk about the climate crisis, I guarantee if I had people, actually I've done this exercise, I did it at UC Santa Barbara. I give a week-long mini course there in climate stuff. And I had everyone in the room write down their definition of global warming. And there was a huge range of what that meant. Is it greenhouse gas-driven global warming? Is it just warming of the planet? Is it the dangerous part of global warming? So and I use this graph just to delineate. There are aspects of this that we know really solidly, and then there are aspects of this that we don't know very well. And basically, a curve like this means it's like a steep. There aren't big tails on the curve of understanding that CO2 is a greenhouse gas. That's why that's a steep curve over there. But unfortunately for society, all the things that matter about global warming are still highly complicated and durably uncertain. The pace of sea level rise through 2100 remains about where it was the range in 1988 when I wrote my first long article. Hurricanes has gotten more complicated. More hurricanes in the higher categories, but fewer hurricanes overall in a warming world. What does that tell you meaningfully? It says, basically, you should always stay out of the way of hurricanes, but it doesn't say global warming is a hurricane issue. It's not. At least it's not clear. Regional climate forecasts are not improving and are unlikely to improve even with a lot more computer power. How much warming, while we know CO2 is a warming gas and it'll make the world warmer, how much warmer, that's still durably wide range. The sensitivity of the climate system to doubled CO2 is a hard problem. And people, you have to kind of cross that off. We're not going to get that one clear anytime soon. Two scientists I know think we can really make some traction there, but most don't. But that's just a way to kind of crystallize that there's ways to move forward in our rhetoric. There's ways to clarify. If you're going to have a debate, you may as well at least have a common sense of what you're debating. And that's important to me. So in an overarching way, though, what that literature and the social science says to me is, if I had to put one bumper sticker on my Prius, would it be fight the climate crisis or join the energy quest? And it would actually be the latter, because I see much more prospect of getting traction on that than I do on the former. And it's just like, you know, where I'm at. And I'm not saying that's right for everybody. There are people on this planet who should be campaigners and organizers. Bill McKibben is a friend of mine. He has a very different view of the science, and I love him for it. But, you know, this is where I am at. And now, back to the web. I do think overall, despite all that noise out there that I mentioned a minute ago, the web really is a miraculous thing. And its potential to do this, Match.com, but not just for, you know, lonely singles or, you know, whatever. It you can match up skill sets across the planet at light speed, or get the right idea to the right place at the right time in a way that was never possible on any kind of meaningful time scale now. So think about this. I was at a meeting of the AAAS, American Association for the Advancement of Science. I hope I'm not spending too much time. I'll be closing in a minute.
You're fine.
A couple of years ago, they had a session there on what the science teachers need. And one thing they need is little explanatory videos, not Discovery Channel epic documentaries on frozen planet. They need like 1 minute explainers just to get this started on an hour course on something. So, and now you have all these students out here with video skills that are unparalleled, because you were all growing up essentially with video as part of your lexicon, and in a way that was certainly not true in the days of Walter Cronkite. And so get the students together with the idea and the need, and you can suddenly start sprouting all kinds of interesting little explainer videos. Now, there's one that's been around on the internet for a few years, made by some college students in California, about geoengineering, which is this idea that, well, we're screwing up the climate so badly now with greenhouse gases, let's screw it up more with like sulfur aerosols or iron fertilization of the ocean. Let's just get even more complicated. And these kids did an explainer that I think is fun as an example.
Today on Waves of the Future, a closer look at geoengineering. What is geoengineering? Well, geoengineering is something global, intentional, and unnatural. And we've got some smart fellers figuring out new methods. Let's look at a few. Space mirrors. In this lifelike reenactment, Eric is the sun and Patrick is the earth. As Patrick orbits Eric, he receives some of Eric's solar radiation, making Patrick very warm. Let's see what Patrick has up his sleeve. By deploying space mirrors, Patrick deflects some of Eric's warming radiation, making himself comfortably cool. Higher near the Galapagos. This is a scale model of the ocean.
So you get the idea. And actually, it's not perfect. There's lots of issues I have with it. And in fact, in the next portion, they misspell the word algae. But you could have a system where you have a sort of a match.com. Hey, I'm a science, harried, underpaid science teacher in Chicago, just got off strike, and I really need, you know, a basic little explainer on what's a greenhouse gas and how do they work. And then you could have students pop a little draft version of one onto a website, and then you could have the science community sort of critique it, and then you could have it become a resource that's a durable resource for science teachers across the country or across the world. So there's ways to do that right now that were just inconceivably just not there a few years ago. And of course, just showing and telling, this has always been true with the capacity. You know, I could tell you the volume of the atmosphere at sea level pressure, I could tell you what that is, or a number of cubic kilometers, or I can show you. And Adam Neiman, a science illustrator in England, a few years back created this illustration to show you the volume of the atmosphere, took all the air, put it at sea level pressure, put it in a spherical volume, that's it. So, and I think that's a great starting point for discussion about any issue related to the global commons. Start there. That could be on the cover of a geography textbook as sort of a basic primer on our resources, including the air. And we have to somehow share that, the 9 billion of us. Here's the water. That green bubble over there is his depiction. And it's not controversial. It's all the world's liquid water from all the rivers and all seas. If you peel away the seas, 2 mile deep oceans, the Great Lakes, et cetera, you put that in a spherical volume, that's it. So my next step with that would be, if I'm doing a course in graphics, science graphics, I'd say, okay, your assignment, class, is to make the bubble for all the world's potable water. How big would that be? And of course, you wouldn't even be able to see it at that scale. It's a fraction of a percent. So that is, to me, a great learning experience that can help you foster a sense of the finite nature of things that we take for granted. Now, fracking. So let's just take a quick tour of Bradford County. I was out there in April. Yuck!
We end up with dry cuttings, which you'll see on the back side of the bag. Fresh water out. The other thing to note about these impoundments is, believe it or not, they're temporary structures. When we're done with developing the wells in this area, we'll fill that all back in. The land will be regraded back to its original contours, and it'll be reclaimed.
I take notes with video camera quite often. It's a lot easier than scribbling.
Days, this will be all in the ground with topsoil back and revegetated.
Hello, I'm Dave Moon, down here in Pennsylvania.
So if you had any advice for landowners just north of the border, a few miles from here in New York, or the politicians, what would you say in terms of what you've learned about gas and fracking these last 4 or 5 years?
Well, as you can see in the background, there's a well site that's on our farm, and you can see down below the farmstead that has been here for generations. I would say do your homework, but have no fear. The gas companies are very easy to work with, environmentally safe. They have fracked the well, our water is fine, and the well is 200 yards from our back door. So I would say that if the opportunity arises in New York, I would certainly be taking a good look at it and seeing what my opportunities are.
So the reason I'm showing this is essentially fracking gives you whatever you want. You can go to an area that's been like big northeastern Pennsylvania, and you can find your fracking. You can, whether depending on which of those sociologically defined sectors of our society you're in, you can find a successful well is here. You can find an industrial process superimposed on a rural landscape, which is at every wellhead. The drilling is what it is. And, they have all these berms to prevent flooding or contamination and all that stuff. But that's not going to satisfy a certain sector of people in this room ever. Because it's fundamental disconnect. For whatever reason, you might have some fear that the rural nature of the landscape is going to get wrecked. We have these divergent attitudes on risk. I have people on my blog who are freaked out about global warming and totally oppose nuclear power, and people on my blog who are freaked out about global warming and so stridently for nuclear power as the only solution that they remain locked in these constant debates. So that says to me some powerful things as well. I see this play out. And Jim Hansen, for all of his concern about global warming, has rejected the idea that he was just at a panel in New York City organized by Greenpeace. And they totally agreed, as I do, that this is a momentous problem, a century-scale problem. But Jim Hansen, again, he rejects he says there's no way you can get there from here with renewable energy. And he thinks that the path toward nuclear power is the way to go. The people right in the room there who asked him to be there were very uncomfortable with that reality because for them, nuclear is a no-go zone. So finding ways to, you know, get comfortable with those differences and then figure out, you know, what do we do are essential. And I think, I guarantee you that people, different people could watch that little postage stamp depiction of fracking country and find different messages in it. We can discuss that. Now, just getting back to information, I think, again, we're poised for wonderful possibilities. We live in a world of constrained resources going forward for decades to come. I feel bad for the young people in this room because of the deficits that are all of our policies in recent decades, from Social Security to militarization, have led to this, you know, this issue of debt. But it means constrained budgets for government oversight of problems. But then there's a guy in Pennsylvania a couple of years ago created a website called fracktrack.org, where he takes all the public data and he, in a couple of days, he built this GIS, this website you can go to, click on the well, find out the well on your road, like this one, I just did this randomly, and find out where there are violations, where the drilling has already happened, where it's pending. You can, so we have this capacity to have our own take at the information. And one thing you need is more information, and that's where government can come in terms of requiring, you know, reports, testing before and after a well is drilled and stuff like that. But then the information and the monitoring, the enforcement actually can come from the public as well. And explanations. I don't know how many of you have seen this. It's far more, to me, far more productive than Gasland. It was made by students at NYU. This entity at NYU, it's basically students working with journalism professors to do data-driven explainers that are captivating. So you get the idea. Hold on, let me just advance it. Now, this is another example of, I was with scientists here earlier today, you know, methane is actually, at the infrared wavelength, is entirely visible. It's like any other kind of pollution, you can see it. So an infrared camera is not expensive. So anyone who's concerned about methane emissions can be out there now, as some scientists here are using other devices to do aerial flyovers, and they're finding ways that we can have potential to use aerial surveillance as a way to keep track of where there's high emissions from well activities. So you can take the bull by the horns. Right now, the community can become much more engaged in making sure that this is a process that gets carried out responsibly and making sure that if there is a lapse, that it's addressed transparently and promptly. And again, I think this is a great time to be getting, you know, a great time for the public to sort of take on the responsibility. Just as we now don't have Walter Cronkite anymore to tell us what to think, we also don't have to wait for someone else to tell us what to do. We can actually use these tools ourselves, whether we're journalists or whether we're just a community that's concerned about an issue. Finally, just Twitter. I'm a big fan of Twitter. I wish I could have tweeted. Maybe I'll tweet while I'm sit down. But you know, most Twitter activity is noise. This is a map. There's a website that maps Twitter activity geographically, and it's mostly just, you know, Justin Bieber, blah blah blah. But it can be your friend, and even NASA. Just go to Twitter and put in asteroid watch, and you'll see how NASA has taken on that issue of keeping track of near-Earth objects that might slam into the planet and help to debunk hype about it and also put out information that's robust about it at the same time. And you can teach with Twitter. There's a class at University of Connecticut that uses the bird class hashtag as their learning tool. The students are assigned to go out into the world, and as they're walking around in the real world, they see a bird do something unusual, they have to tweet it. So I think that's awesome. And my class at Pace, my blogging class is Pace Blog, so you can kind of watch my students doing their work by following that hashtag. There's much more to say about that too. And in the end, you know, I loved Manahatta, the project by Steve Sanderson, who was at the Wildlife Conservation Society, where he did a methodical science-based study of Manhattan Island and the region, looking back at what it was like 400 years ago, and then considering where we are now. And we can use tools like this now to start to envision where we're going to go from here. Obviously, we're never going to go back to pre-Columbian days. And obviously, we're going to deal with issues, including rising sea levels in places like Manhattan, that are going to change the shape of that city going forward. But using these tools to sort of articulate change over time and find ways forward that are constructive and build a better planet has never been more possible than it is now. So I think that's, again, this all excites me tremendously. And this is that your longtime faculty member here, Carl Sagan, who wonderfully inspired me a long time ago to get into my line of work, talked about this photograph of the pale blue dot, and I'm here. So I'm easy to find. I'll be even easier to find for the next half hour or so, 45 minutes over there. So thank you.
Great. Hey, everybody, this is how it's going to work. Now it's your turn to ask questions. There are going to be two microphone holders on either side of the room, so you can you'll be able to raise your hand. We also have questions coming in. This is live streaming, so we have questions coming in by email that I'll be sending on to Andy. So I'm going to start with one, just to carry on with this fracking theme. Sure. I think the relatively low value of gas from stores such as the Marcellus has given us an unusual opportunity to get it right. What kind of positive role models for a process of regulation can you envision for us? And I think, you know, I mean, certainly a recent decision by Governor Cuomo to hold the moratorium until we have a better, more confidence in public health impacts kind of supports that. But how do we go forward on this now that we have a little breathing room?
Well, I you know, in a way, it may be helpful because it'll help to sort of curtail the hyperventilated rhetoric that built around fracking in the wake of what happened in Pennsylvania and other states, because they had the worst of it, where they had the high price and the sense of this being a predatory drive. And New York has the capacity, as a state that's led on environmental regulation for decades, and the time now, because of the low gas price, and because the reality of this, as I've written, and as Chip Northrup, who's a strident foe of fracking, has written from a different perspective, is that it's going to be a slow process. And there was always this sense of urgency that was built up by campaigners either banned for the ban or for the bonanza, that this was an urgent matter, that people's livelihoods were at stake for those wanting to drill, and that the environment was critically poised for destruction. And I think now you can actually have a reality-based discussion, which I think is a good thing.
Yeah. Are there other questions out here? Where are the mics? There's questions up here. Right here.
Hi. Just to follow up with that idea about, you know, there's not the urgency. Aren't the amounts of methane being leaked? And I sort of feel like climate change is urgent, period. So in some ways, maybe we have more time, but in another way, I think we're already running this race way behind where we need to be. And so one thing that I've struggled with is how do you reconcile what is obviously actually terribly deep urgency with the fact that, like you say, not everybody's in the same place about this. And it's one thing to say, let's take our time and get people into my camp, and I totally understand that approach. On the other hand, you have this urgency that is real, that you need to convey for action to occur at a pace that can possibly address these problems. So how do you reconcile that?
Well, you don't in the end. You don't reconcile it, but you have to consider the realities. And now the realities that include that, again, something like 98% of the growth in emissions in the next 30 years is not going to be here. I'm talking about greenhouse gas emissions in total. It's going to be in China and India after China. So as I wrote recently, if you care about climate change, it may in fact be that the best possible thing you could do is find ways to help China facilitate a shift from coal to gas. There, because as you know, as you may or may not know, the renewable energy growth in China is great, but it's on top of coal. It's in addition to coal. It's not supplanting coal. Gas can supplant coal. That's already been happening here. You just look at the last 5 years, and you can see how coal burning has been reduced by the move to natural gas, on top of what happened with the recession and on top of the other things that have slowed our growth in emissions. So to me, a realistic look at the next few decades would say you're not going to get China's not going to get off of coal and move directly to renewables, period. Not going to happen, as we know that. So what can you do in the meantime, as China has the world's greatest build-out of sort of energy systems in history? And to me, going forward, a focus on gas there, and they're very focused on it. China was was gas impoverished until recently when they did the calculations of shale deposits there, and now it's I think it's larger than our estimates here. So I just can't get away from the reality to me that gas has to play a meaningful role here as well. If you take gas off the agenda and you look at energy needs in New York, by the way, you know, knowing that New York already, virtually all the gas that New York burns, I don't know what you cook on, but I'm on propane. I'm in a rural area in Putnam County, but propane is a derivative of gas drilling. And I talked to a strident foe of fracking and who I met recently in Garrison where I lived, and she lives in New York City, and I said, what do you cook on? She cooks on gas, but 95% of it comes from some other part of the country. And so to say we're not going to drill for gas here, but we're going to burn it, to me says we're missing something there ethically, morally. I don't understand that, how you could say it's okay for it to come from another state where it's drilled however it may be drilled. Same thing with oil. I kind of like the idea and of taking some ownership of our energy realities. And one of the other things I think has been beneficial for fracking and the fracking debate is that essentially it's Americans confronting where their energy comes from. And it's often a dirty process. And you know, and the idea that we can move magically to renewables right away is just, you can't do that. It's just, you can't. I mean, you can't and have New York's economy be anywhere near it is where it is now. And actually, if you wanted renewables to be a substantially larger part of our portfolio of energy options in New York State, you have to have gas to be that flexing source of generation of electricity for when there's big fluctuations in the web, the energy web. So it's like, you know, when you look at these issues out of isolation, and I think too much of the discussion of things like fracking has been in isolation, like saying no this. Well, I'm in the blog, I've gotten in the habit of saying, okay, no this and no this. What are you saying yes to? And show me the numbers that would make that a meaningful part of our energy menu. And I'm not happy. You know, that illustration of the video I shot of fracking, the gas, that's just the drilling process, not the fracking. It's an industrial process, and it's in the middle of a rural place, and it doesn't feel good. It makes me go, ooh, I wouldn't want that down my road. The part of the Hudson Valley I live in will not be, there's no, the Marcellus is not there. So finding ways to have a meaningful outcome when you have these national and global energy imperatives and issues, and then you have real on-the-ground divergence, like the guy who is really happy with his well, you know, and the neighbor down the road who may not be happy with all the truck traffic that went into drilling that well. You know, that's why I say don't expect some magical working out. But I think you're seeing how we work this out, playing out in New York State, again, is, I think we have the best of all possible worlds now. Because the urgency is gone. You can have a limited, careful, and heavily oversighted initial steps in this direction. I mean, Walter Hang, I don't know if he's here, who I've known for 20 years from covering other stuff, toxics targeting. You know, everyone's poised to sue. So every aspect of that, of those rules and regulations that's not up to snuff will be challenged. Every well project will be challenged. You know, this is not just going to kind of unfold and transform the New York landscape in a quick way.
Question back there, the red. Where are the mics? The other thing about this process is everybody only gets one question, okay? And then we'll cut you off.
But you can follow up. Remember, Revkin, at Revkin on Twitter and Revkin at Gmail.
We want to give everybody a chance to talk. Where are the mics?
I have it.
Okay,
I have it.
Sorry.
So you talked a little bit about how information doesn't really convince people of things, and I think that's really interesting and true. I've heard that before, and but you're right. It does go against a lot of what people have been trying to do, and even yourself, as you said.
Yeah.
And it seems like the way we reach these areas of common ground is through common beliefs. So, I mean, that makes sense. What more specifically have people done on this, and how well have those common beliefs been articulated by, you referred sort of generally to people who are studying this and trying to see, like, strategically, how can we actually do something that people all believe in and as more of a motivating force?
Well, this relates to the question we just hashed out a minute ago, which is you're never going to get everyone to believe one thing in this realm, but you look for opportunities to get people who believe differently to act the same. And that's apparently Walter Lippmann is famous for having said this: politics is the art of getting people who think differently to act the same. In other words, you're not going to get consensus, but you can get points of action, like efficiency standards for cars. Very few people say no to that. And then, remember Richard Nixon created the EPA. There was a time in this country when we had bipartisan concern about basic environmental issues. The Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, Endangered Species Act were all done under Republican-dominated politics because you found ways to have common engagement on issues. There are some basic political realities, like the 60-vote supermajority in the Senate, that are going to prohibit, sort of, can allow a very small faction to derail even really logical, highly consensual ideas. The Law of the Sea Treaty is being hijacked, has been under Republicans and Democrats for two decades by like six senators. Some of them have died off over time, but there's, you know, that's a part of our politics that's really tough. But there are areas where you can move forward. I think it's just finding creative ways to. And as I said earlier about the climate vulnerability to climate extremes, you can have that conversation and be, if you're a little patient with the conversation about mitigation, you can have some meaningful action, like the flooding of roads and the irrational nature of our rebuilding standards and stuff like that. That there's things you could do now that I've seen wide arrays of people agree on who would never agree on a carbon tax, for example.
Question in the back there. Yeah. Thanks.
I'm wondering. I'm having a hard time following your assertion that we can have commonality on some things, and you give examples. For example, one approach that we might take for global warming is to try to help the Chinese, and then the Indians find a way to convert from coal to gas, as if converting to gas would solve the global warming issue. I mean, I believe the person who asked the first question started out by saying, you know, I feel strongly that it is a very pressing issue, global warming and climate change, and went on to talk about gas drilling, and the reason that is highly related to it is because of the methane leakage and the gas industries, the whole fossil fuel industries, apparent unwillingness and probably being unable to make any real dent in that issue, in that problem. But you go ahead and say, well, here's how we can solve a problem, and perhaps with some common ground so that we can come to a common belief about things. How is it that we can have the information in front of us, the question asked to you directly, not 3 or 4 minutes before that, And then I hear you just ignoring it as if...
Well, I'll address it directly because we're not going to solve the climate problem. Anyone who tells you that we're going to solve the climate problem is fantasizing. The nature of this problem is not that it's solvable. We can address the climate problem for what it is, a century scale. It took us a century to get into this bollocks. And it's not going to be a one treaty or a one legislative bill or one technology path to limiting climate risk. Limiting risk from climate change to human and natural systems is what I think we have to see as the best possible outcome. And to me, moving a country that's burning X billion tons of coal a year, which is already harming thousands of people, tens of thousands of people's lives, as well as adding greatly to climate change, moving them to a fuel, if it's done responsibly, meaning leakage, and I wrote a page one article about all the different ways you can cut leaks now. The green completions of gas wells is a phenomenal way to greatly reduce that emissions burst that comes at the end of a conventional drilling. Has to be a win, especially because if it gets to the point where things are bad enough that you want to capture carbon dioxide emissions from burning fossil fuels and store them somewhere, it's much easier to do that from natural gas than it is from coal. So you're already setting yourself up down the line for the next steps by moving to gas in a way that I don't know what your alternative for China is, to just keep yelling at China to build more windmills, when you know that the windmills they're building are on top of their coal expansion. Remember, Australia passed a climate bill even as it's exporting hundreds of millions of tons of coal to China, and the accounting for that carbon isn't included in their bill. Mm-hmm. Would you rather have us pass some rosy-sounding piece of legislation like that, even as we're not actually dealing with the problem? Or would you rather see us on a prismatic way, in a Bill McKibben silver buckshot way, creating the intentionality to move progressively toward decarbonization as well as we can, generation by generation? I take the latter approach. I just don't see any realistic prospect that we're going to get it as right by doing the other thing. The climate treaty, the Kyoto Treaty, has proved just as hollow when you look at all the out clauses and the way China has gamed the system there with the, most of the carbon credits have gone toward things that aren't actually doing anything for climate. I just don't see any reasonable argument on another line. But that's just me.
So I've got a couple of questions from email. Sure. There's some evidence from recent surveys that more Americans believe in climate change and the consensus science. What role, if any, will climate change in particular and environment in general play in this November's election?
None. No, it's the economy. I'm not calling you stupid.
It wasn't my question.
none. It's not. There's a body of research, and it's robust, that leads to in people examining what people care about to the point where they change their lives or change how they vote. And there was a woman at UC Irvine. In 2006, a story I did called Yelling Fire on a Hot Planet. She's a social scientist who said the things that people vote on are things that are soon, salient, and certain. And you can Google for it easily. And tell me what aspects of climate are soon, salient, and certain, to the extent that they are the kind of thing that you can ascribe directly to greenhouse gas-driven climate change and say, this is changing my life right now. It's not there. So I don't see it having a meaningful role.
And then another one. I'm not going to argue with you on that.
Okay.
Why should
I would like it to be more meaningful, but it's not.
Why should hydrofracking industry be exempt from Clean Water Act,
they shouldn't
Clean
be.
Air Act, and the toxic substance laws?
They shouldn't be. Period. It's correct. So that you can vote on.
That's our job.
Yeah, that's something to work on. Yeah. The Cheney effect. Okay. Ironically, though, funny, Wyoming, Cheney's home state, now requires disclosure of all the chemicals that go into a fracked well. So if it can happen in Wyoming, that means there's prospects for progress.
Well, hopefully that's where we're headed. So I guess, can you pass the mic into her? And then, John, do you have somebody with a mic up there? Okay, we'll get you. Yep, go ahead.
Hi. I appreciate your reporting focused on building awareness on climate change over the years. You mentioned the need to focus on finding common ground around questions of sustainable energy rather than focusing on opposing views related to climate change and fracking. Yet, I'd say your reporting fails to question why there are divergent views and the power dynamics at play with those opposing views. Your reporting doesn't address the influence of the fossil fuel industry on the political system, media, and university research, which I would say is the reason why we haven't acted on climate change and why industry rhetoric says that fracking can be done safely. So I guess my question is, what do you think has been the major impediment to climate action in the U.S., if not the influence of the fossil fuel industry?
I don't say the influence doesn't matter. Remember, I broke stories during the Bush administration about the role of industry in influencing how the administration edited reports on climate change. So it absolutely is there. Industry disinformation is there. But is it the pivotal thing? Is it the reason we're not decarbonizing rapidly? I think not. I wrote a piece a couple of years ago that Joe Rahm was not happy with, but that's his problem, called What if public had perfect climate information? In other words, if you had the ability now to take away all the hype around this issue and present the climate challenge for what it is to the public, and if you had a tutorial every day on NPR and on the nightly news, if you could somehow enforce that, the question is, would that make people change their energy choices and or raise the price of fossil energy? I don't think that would happen. I mean, it's a hypothesis, you can't prove it. But I see fundamental impediments, especially in a time of economic turmoil, to having that take traction, even if you remove the industry influence. Now the influence of industry money in Congress is a huge deal, and that goes way beyond fracking and carbon. And the more we can do to make that transparent, but you know, this gets to these primal issues about the nature of our democracy and recent Supreme Court decisions that, again, goes far beyond just the questions that you're talking about with energy and climate change. So the question to me, though, still is, if we had perfect information, would we aggressively decarbonize the energy choices in this country, given what I've seen and understood in traveling around America and big chunk of the world? I just don't see that as happening. It's not just an information problem. That's the bottom. It's not a climate challenge is not an information problem. It is fundamentally still a technology problem to me.
We got the next question up here.
Thank you. Mr. Revkin, I appreciate that this is a very difficult issue, as are many issues in terms of trying to find consensus. I should start by introducing myself. I'm State Assemblywoman Barbara Lifton. I've been very, very involved in the fracking issue in New York State. I feel a little defensive at a lot of the things that have been said. When I hear environmental, I've forgotten the language you've used, but hype, and you didn't use the word extremists, but something that made me feel like, you know, if you're strongly against fracking, you know, you're not analyzing data properly. And I've spent the last 4 years of my life, you know, 80% of my time, and my staff are on my right and my staff are on my left, spending 80% of their time for the last 3 or 4 years. Our files are yay big. We have studied and studied and studied. So I don't consider any of that hype or misinformation. I've been to Pennsylvania twice and spent all day listening to people in Pennsylvania. People with their water destroyed, their property destroyed. It's my understanding, although I can't get clear information from the industry, I had the lobbyists in my office giving me a very interesting story about their fantasy, I think, about what was happening in Washington County, Pennsylvania. I'm concerned that you put a man up there that said, everything's great on my farm. And I realize you did the Yale students video too, but it seems to me in portraying Pennsylvania, you're implying that, hey, things are really okay there maybe, or acceptable. But it's my understanding that in one county alone, in Washington County, Pennsylvania, there are 400 families that are having water delivered to them for the past 2 years. This is massive environmental destruction. This is destruction of water. So, you know, when you say New York ought to do this because we use gas, I don't find that a satisfactory answer, that it's hypocritical. I think that since we're finding out about all of these problems now from all the different states, it seems to me that we're all in a position of saying, yeah, I'm using gas in my kitchen right now. I'd love to figure out a way out of that. And we need state policy and federal policy to help us all out of that. Never mind Bob Howard's work on climate change. I'm not quite hearing your answer on that. We've got fouled water and destroying the climate at the same time. I don't see this as a way forward. I don't see this as the way to go. So, sorry to go on.
No, it's but okay. It's okay. And but you're kind of implying that New York can't do better than Pennsylvania. You seem to be implying there's a static, that this is a static issue that we're stuck. Of course. Which is why it's not going to happen here. Not because you're going to ban it, but because it's going to be uneconomical. Exactly. Well, I wrote also about the need for DEC to split off its minerals management from its environmental enforcement. But those are issues you can work on. You know, there's things there to work on. The United States, the federal government did it after they had a disaster that led to it, but it's doable. So the idea, to me though, there's something discouraging, especially in America, to think that time passes and we're still stuck with the norms that you see in Pennsylvania when there was a rush driven by high prices that was predatory and where there were areas where there were real problems. But at the same time, Bob Howarth, he's not here today. I was with him an hour ago. He said, Tony and Graffia said, you know, 95% of wells are drilled correctly. So industry, and that was Tony and Graffia saying that, but there are wells that are not. So I don't know the answer to how you have an energy policy that protects everyone perfectly. You will not have that question. You will not ever have that. So how do you insulate how do you create a policy that works, you know, for everyone? I don't know. That's not what he said an hour ago.
Barbara, thanks, but we can't continue it as a dialogue. Over there, John, yeah, thanks very much. And then Frank, back up there in the middle in the orange shirt. Yeah, we'll get you next. We'll get you there. We'll get you next.
So, can you hear me? So my question is actually just a follow-up. As a concerned citizen, I would, of course, be interested in policies or ways of voting, or how do you inform people that, you know, you know, I'm using methane, I'm using natural gas to cook and that sort of thing. And so I'd just be curious, Andy, about what you think is a way as concerned citizens to push that conversation. So, you know, if we do need this step of natural gas in between, what does that transition strategy look like?
It kind of looks like what's playing out in New York State, essentially, which is a real push to make sure we get it as right as possible. And I think everything, the pressure from the community, the Walter Hangs, and the legislators who have deep concerns, and the environmental groups, and is kind of, that's how we do it in America. It's very not pretty sometimes, and it requires all these kinds of, this kind of engagement. But what I like about what I've seen this last 2 years is the engagement, that people finally are considering, where does my energy come from? And the more we have that conversation, the more you'll also see the possibility that a Cuomo or whoever else will actually, when they articulate what's going to happen, it's articulated as part of a broader energy policy for the state, so that if we're going to do fracking, we're going to do this and that for efficiency as well. And, you know, if we're going to have our mandates for, basically, so you're thinking about the whole picture. Because current practices are not, we don't have an American energy policy right now that's meaningful. Whether Obama stays in office or whether Romney comes in, I don't think you're going to see much change there. And it's unfortunate, But at the same time, we use a lot of energy in this country to drive my Prius here. You know, it was better than driving our old minivan, but it's 50 miles a gallon is awesome, but that's still energy use. And turning on the lights and turning on the faucet and, you know, having a hot shower, these are real things. John Cronin, the river keeper for decades on the Hudson River, now works with me at Pace University. He and I agree that the more we can do as a country to sort of take ownership of our energy choices, the better off we'll be in the long run. His big passion is oil in Nigeria. We buy, I can't remember what the percentage of our oil comes from Nigeria. It's something like 7%, 10%. And when was the last time you thought about the conditions that came from the oil use that comes from our demand for oil that is ruining people's lives? And if you think the 400 families in Washington County having to have bottled water is a tragedy, you should see what happens routinely in the places we harvest our energy from right now without thinking about it. So I'm all for engagement and embracing the reality of our energy needs. And I think from there forward, that gives you more impetus just to conserve and to innovate, both in terms of how you extract more cleanly and how you use less in the end and move to renewable options in the long run.
Frank, in the orange shirt right behind you, Jonathan. Yeah, there you go. He's been waiting a while. Thanks, everybody. I know it's tough, and we'll get to you.
I guess I'm sort of following up on some of the comments that Barbara Lifton made. It seems to me that you make a lot of leaps in making a case for natural gas. Like, for instance, sometimes many people who model what would it look like if most of our energy was coming from renewables say, well, you've got to have some kind of a baseline. But the amount of gas drilling, and that's not a quantitative 30 or 40 or 50% of our electricity has to come from gas to do that. It's usually a very small percentage. So it's way, you know, as an argument for why we have to have this huge boom on fracking, it's a real disconnect. And in fact, if you really wanted to say that we need that,
I'm not saying we have to
a
have
long time
boom.
Into the future, you'd want
just
to conserve that.
Just to be clear,
natural.
I'm not saying we should have a huge boom. Yeah. I'm saying we should have a process unfold that is carefully managed for both the rare worst case and to make sure that those who seek to, if they choose to, can harvest this resource responsibly, including the landowners who want to do it. But with a lot of oversight and absolute accountability and liability in the long run. And these things are not there yet. But a ban doesn't even allow the discussion around the rules and regulations to play out. And again, right now is the best possible option. You've got a low gas price for years to come, many, many years to come. You have you don't have any of the pressure there to get it wrong.
That doesn't seem given that it's going to stay low for many, many years to come. I mean, they're working hard to create whole new markets, to export it. I mean, that could turn around as quickly as the prices dropped a year or two ago.
Well, not quickly, but
one question.
It'll take many years for it to become a significant transportation fuel.
Where we go? How about back there in the orange sweater, Frank?
Thank you. I just wanted to respond to the whole idea of oversight with our DEC being very understaffed and the prospect of it being sufficiently staffed to really monitor this industry. I kind of wonder, are we supposed to all as citizens go out there with our infrared cameras and start looking for methane?
You also have Walter Hang. You have, you know, you well, have, that's I mean, what the not, NGOs are for
would
as
you
well.
Let me finish. It seems to me that, you know, it shouldn't be the responsibility of average citizens who have jobs and families and other responsibilities to monitor the mistakes or problems that a highly profitable industry makes. It seems to me that oversight should be really funded by the industry that is potentially causing these problems. And I think also that brings up the very real fear that people have that if there is a problem, that they're going to be the David against the Goliath, that they're not going to have any legal leg to stand on with an industry that, even if they do disclose what chemicals they're using, in order for an individual landowner to prove, or individual person to prove that well, you know, on the neighbor's property, you know, contaminated their water, it's almost impossible to do that. So I think that, yeah, the non-disclosure agreements that have been so prominent in the settlements of these sorts of disputes. I think it's not just a question of finding better technology or finding better regulations. I think there's a huge lack of trust, which is based on some very, very real problems that underlie all of this.
I just wanted to say thanks, everybody, and we'll appreciate if you keep your questions kind of short because there are a lot of people asking. Go ahead.
And those are powerful and important concerns. My mic. Hello? Hello? Did I lose my mic?
One. I'm on.
We can trade it back and forth. Not quite sure what happened there. There have to be financial instruments developed, New York, in terms of whether it's a tax or something that helps the industry finance the oversight of the industry. I'm not saying that it's all up to the community. That would be ridiculous. But I do think there's incredible power now with technologies that are available and cheap for the community to take on some of that role as well. But I'm not saying that it's free range and that you have to go up against, Chesapeake in court. The government has an important role to play going forward. But I don't see evidence yet that, let's see what comes out the other end of this protracted pipeline in New York State. I can't imagine that we'll end up with a situation where something will go forward that doesn't have those components in it. Remember, this is all still fantasy baseball so far. And there'll be litigation for years from environmental groups that will help to make sure that there are the gaps in these rules will be addressed. I have a lot of respect for the people I have met over decades at the groups that are well-funded and can kind of make that difference. NRDC and others are there and ready. So I'm not so sure I'm as worried as you are. Although again, as I said earlier today, or maybe it was here, I live in a part of the Hudson Valley where there will not be fracking. And if there were a landowner down the road who was able to drill, I would probably have a different view of it than I do now. I'm not saying that these are illegitimate arguments. This is an issue that is super wicked because you have this, the two scales are really hard to reconcile. The scale of national energy policy, the scale of coal benefits, the benefit of moving off of coal compared to moving to gas. Everything has to be looked at in the sense of trade-offs as well. And I don't see an easy resolution there. Sorry.
I have a question here from Bill Schlesinger. What do we know about the volatilization of methane, nitrous oxide, and hydrocarbons from the flowback waters that are held in ponds near drill sites?
I know, Bill.
Very specific.
Oh, this is working now. I'd have to look it up.
Okay. All right, so we'll pass on that one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's see. Questions back there, the man in the green?
I wouldn't mind. As long as it's a brief question, I'm happy to take it. That's true.
My life fighting to make this earth a better place. I actually have a very big love for journalism, and as you know, I contacted you about the lake source cooling issue. But we're dealing with hydrofracking now, and it's in our doorstep. And I was puzzled because you're a journalist. The New York Times had many articles, extensive articles, on this issue. And they talked about the problems. They talked about the fact that, there's no regulation because Cheney undid all the laws. I was, like Barbara, stunned that you didn't give the other side, you didn't interview a farmer that has been affected.
I showed you the process viscerally and
you,
how ugly.
You showed your students, which is very telling that your students came out.
No.
Okay.
That video, can you pause for a second?
What I'm trying to say...
Can you please pause?
What I'm trying to say is, as a journalist, you can come here and really lay it out very well what's going on. And you haven't succeeded, I'm sorry to say, done that. In terms of a ban, I think a ban will give us plenty of time to think about what's going on and maybe figure out what if we can do this in the future? This is not in your backyard. It's in our backyard. And I think we have a right to want this done better. Okay, right now, the industry is not doing it better. And the New York Times had many examples of how they're not doing it better, and they refuse to compensate people that have been affected. Now, in terms of the world crisis, I would love to talk to you for many, many days, and I would, okay, because we have a major problem on this planet. And I agree with you, one thing you showed about the graph of population growth, we have a problem because we don't have enough
Let's let him answer, please.
Fill our energy needs.
Thanks
now,
for your
that
question.
Doesn't mean that we should go ahead with an energy where the regulations are...
I gave you my card. We can talk about these.
Make a broad scale, if they want to do hydrofracking, say that we are we're putting all the chemicals out.
Yeah.
Do you understand?
You need to stop.
And the last thing
was that people were lied to about this process. Yeah.
Because they thought it would be the old way.
I just want to get it.
So they signed on.
I know, but you have to do it.
Okay, thanks. We're moving on to the next question back there in the green shirt, gentlemen.
Sorry.
Now you've made me look like an idiot. You're the idiot. All of you are the idiots who avoided me with the mic. And now you made a seat. You succeeded to make a seat. No.
Okay. Next question, please. Thanks, Frank. Thank you.
So my question is, does it matter if it's vertical drilling without hydrofracking? Or if it's horizontal drilling without hydrofracking.
No, to the extent...
Or if it's horizontal drilling just with hydrofracking. Do any of these make any difference in terms of people's perception?
Well, there has been too much conflation of those processes. But the reality is it's the horizontal and fracturing, the horizontal drilling and fracturing that facilitates a lot more vertical drilling. In other words, the reason there's more drilling is because you can do the horizontal stuff. There is limited evidence that the actual fracturing of the rock at those deep layers can produce leakage that can migrate up to a meaningful level and toward like water supplies. But it's true that it's that process that has created this boom in drilling, absolutely. So you wouldn't have all the vertical holes if you didn't have the capacity to do the horizontal stuff. So I do agree that overall it should be considered. I think I was with either Bob Howarth or Tony Agrafia earlier today said, we shouldn't describe this as a debate about fracking or not fracking. It's a debate about gas extraction from shale, period.
People have been fracking for years. Yeah.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Fracking is an unremarkable technology. It's the combination of these things that has led to this boom in extraction of gas from shale, period. In other words, that's the issue. So unfortunately, it's gotten conflated around that one word.
Okay, I have a question that I'll cut to the chase and then give a little context for it. Basically, I'm wondering why you have so much faith in New York State's ability to properly regulate this. And the context I'd like to provide is that I see two kinds of foxes around the greenhouse, around the chicken house. One are the ones designing the chicken coop. And they're the ones that have been drafting the regulations in New York State or preventing regulations from getting passed and also preventing laws that frame regulations from getting passed. The other is the more typical use of fox and hen house, which are the foxes guarding the hen house, and that is the more standard regulatory capture, also known as the revolving door. And I have spoken to multiple people in the DEC who assure me to this last question, there's no significant new technology involved in fracking. We've been doing it safely for 60 years. I've been in the business and I know, including a former DEC commissioner. And it really concerns me that the people in the DEC who will be overseeing this do not see significant differences in fracking as it's now done. The other huge hole I see with no regulation is fracking waste. And even if it never comes to New York because there's not enough gas to make it profitable here, it is happening in Pennsylvania, and drill cuttings and frack water are coming into New York. Radioactive gas is coming in through our pipelines, and clean water is leaving via tanker trains. I mean, there's just huge amounts of regulation needed that go way, way beyond what happens the day a well is drilled, the day a well is fracked. And I'm just, again, wondering why you think New York is going to regulate this safely when so far there are such huge gaps.
I guess I'll go back to my interactions with Chip Northrup, who I've posted recently his stuff on .earth as well, where it's the reality that we're going to see a slow process. It's going to take years, and that will involve, as I said repeatedly, a lot of challenges that you're not going to have wells drilled. I think he said most recently, and he's a strident, Chip Northrup, if you haven't followed his blogging on fracking, he's about as strident a foe of this process as anyone out there. But he has said that, you know, you're not going to see anything in the state for years to come because of industry's awareness of the high costs that's going to come inevitably here compared to doing it elsewhere, if any, you know. That I just don't see this as playing out in a way where you're going to...
We're seeing drill cuttings in our landfills now.
From Pennsylvania? Are those sealed landfills, though? In other words, is there any risk attached to that?
Radioactive.
Well, I don't know how to proceed except to have a prolonged look at the data on things like the level of radioactivity that we're talking about compared to what's background radiation as well, and whether the landfills were licensed where this stuff is going, and whether it's, you know, is there oversight of that?
I don't know. And the point is, it's been reclassified as non-hazardous, but if you go, you know, that's what I'm saying. About the process, that it's not going to happen. That's a regulatory failure. And there are no, there's no tracking needed, and wastewater leaves a well site. We don't know where it goes, but we know there's a nice clean roads program that's going brine on roads.
Well, we'll have to continue this online, I think. I'd like you to engage on my blog, and I give as much space there. Again, I don't censor comments or anything. It's an open discussion of these issues. And as I said, there is no clean resolution to this. There's no way to have an energy future for this country that doesn't have risk in some places. So how do you find ways to mitigate that risk and to make sure that there's accountability and there's nothing that's, you get to the question of the scope of the risk and the where it's irreversible or not, and it leads to some pretty uncomfortable realities that I think are just part of us coming to grips finally with our energy issues that in a way that hasn't happened here. This didn't happen with coal, you know, because there was no community awareness of when Pennsylvania in the 1800s was ravaged for all the coal that's there, all the methane that's leaking out of the coal mines now. Is just as significant as what's coming from fracking. But no one was there to say, oh, and now we're there. So I think we're slowly inching toward having actual energy policy. And I think you have to look at things as being compared to what. And unless we're all going to live in the dark, that becomes a pretty tough question to ask and address. I've lived the imposed low-carbon life, you know, through five-day blackouts, as I'm sure many of you have, when some of the big storms came through here the last couple of years. And, you know, things are not easy when that happens. So we're not going to be off the grid. And we have to, I think we're engaging in that process of coming out with something that can be more sustainable. And I don't expect easy answers. So, but I'd like to continue the conversation.
I think our time's up, everybody. I want to thank you all. And we especially want to thank Andy. Join me for thanking him. I appreciate it, Andy.